Case number 13-1313, CSX Transportation, Inc., petitioner versus Surface Transportation Board et al. Mr. Himmelsbach for the petitioner, Mr. Hunt for the respondents.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Paul Himmelsbach with the law firm Sidley Austin. I'm representing petitioner CSX Transportation in this petition today. At the very outset, I'd like to make clear and emphasize that we are making two arguments that the Court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal. The first argument is that the agency adopted a legislative rule in this proceeding without notice and comment required by the Administrative Procedure Act. That alone, that error alone, is sufficient to remand, to vacate and remand this decision and rule it embodies to the agency without anything further. Our second argument is that the decisions themselves constitute a final agency order. Again, a separate basis for jurisdiction under the Hobbs Act. The Hobbs Act, as you know, unlike the APA, provides for review of both final orders and rules and regulations, and we're asserting jurisdiction under the Hobbs Act. I'd like to focus on the APA lack of notice and comment argument first. And I think it's important to explain a little bit of the context and the prior rules and the substantial transformational changes that the agency made in the new rule from the rules that have existed and been applied for the past 30 years. Under the prior rules, the agency has long acknowledged that the statute requires a two-prong inquiry, the first being quantitative market dominance, which is determined by application of a ratio of revenue to variable costs. Once that determination is made, if the agency under that clears that, or if the rates at issue clear that threshold, then the agency proceeds to consider qualitative market dominance. Qualitative market dominance is what is at issue in this case. Under the rules that have existed again since 1981 and amended with in ways that are not directly relevant here, the agency has conducted a totality of circumstances in which it analysis in which it considers a variety of different attributes of the transportation at issue for each specific market. So, for example, whether the customer, the shipper, is able to use trucks, and what proportion of its shipments use trucks, or are there other alternative modes, and the qualities and attributes of the products, and the distance of the haul, and those sorts of factors, a whole variety of factors that are not readily quantifiable.
So what I'm struggling with is, in the context of an adjudication where an agency makes an interlocutory or a decision that is at the in the middle of the adjudication, before the final decision, let's say, to put it in plain language. And you may say it's procedurally improper or substantively improper, but it still seems less than final from my perspective, at least. And maybe when it is final, all these arguments make sense to consider. But it just doesn't seem like, even if they did something improper like this in an adjudication from your perspective, that we should be wading into it at this point.
Let me add to that, because it's an interesting approach you took to try and avoid the question that my colleague has raised by saying, well, let's hold off on the finality. I want to go to the failure of notice and comment. I don't think that does it. That's a question you can raise post-adjudication as well, that they couldn't do this by adjudication.
Unless you're arguing specifically that there's no finality requirement for
right.
Review of an improperly issued order.
Sure, Your Honor. This court has held on numerous occasions that the deprivation of the Administrative Procedure Act procedures, the notice and comment, is a final injury that is immediately appealable.
In the middle of an adjudication?
In some cases, it has happened in the middle of an adjudication.
Is there really such a case? I mean, if there is, that's I love.
There is indeed such a case, Your Honor.
Right in the middle of the adjudication, we stopped it and we said we close this down.
Yes, Your Honor.
In
Athlone versus the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the CPSC asserted that it had jurisdiction to conduct a certain kind of administrative proceeding.
Right.
The Athlone believed it could not. Athlone went to the district court and said, district court, please enjoin this proceeding because the agency is without authority. The district court rejected that, and then they took that up to this court.
Right.
And this court held that that was a final, definitive determination
there are
of jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. There are a handful of cases where the assertion is the agency has no authority to act whatsoever. That's certainly not this case. I'm not aware of any case where there's no doubt that the agency has the authority to act with respect to these parties, and carriers are covered by the agency, that we blocked an ongoing proceeding to make a determination, as Judge Kavanaugh says, whether it's procedural, evidentiary, substantive, whatever, and judged it at that moment. There are cases going just the opposite way in the circuit that say we don't do that.
Your Honor, this is the jurisdictional statute here, to be clear, narrowly limits what rates the agency may assert jurisdiction over, because Congress determined that the vast majority of rates should be level of them should be determined by competition.
Let me get at it another way, see if I can understand your argument. Suppose the agency had denied the motion for bifurcation. Okay?
Yes.
Do you think you would have had an appealable order?
Well, it would have. The orders would have happened at the same time in that instance, Your Honor. So I think the question would not have arisen, because
No. You came in and said bifurcate, because there's a preceding question on whether or not there's market dominance, which is what's underscoring your argument. You're saying you're trying to make it a jurisdictional type argument. And the word jurisdiction does not appear in the statute the way you're asserting it. That's not the way the statute is written. I read that very, very carefully. There is no such suggestion. It is true that they have no authority to go to reasonable rates absent a preceding determination with regard to market dominance, but there's nothing to suggest jurisdiction or non-jurisdiction. I mean, but in any event, if you go to the agency and say, you have to bifurcate because, in your theory, you have no authority to do anything unless you make a certain determination on market dominance. And the agency says, no, we're not going to bifurcate. Can you appeal that?
No, Your Honor.
Then I don't know how you're here.
Well, because the agency has made a jurisdictional determination, and the...
So their mistake was in stupidly saying we'll bifurcate. So you're saying if they had said...
Huh? At their request.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
Well, we requested just...
I don't know how you can possibly win on that theory. I thought you would agree, because you're a smart guy. I thought you would agree there's no appealable order if they say No, we're not going to bifurcate. We're going to do what we've been doing for years and years and years. We're just going to try this whole mess, and at the end we'll have something, and then you go to court and...
I may have misunderstood you. I did. If had they denied our request that they make an expedited determination of jurisdiction, that was certainly within their discretion to do. And we could not have appealed.
Absolutely.
That I misunderstood your question, I guess.
Their mistake was in doing it?
Well, it wasn't a mistake because they genuinely...
In terms of appealability...
Their mistake was establishing a new rule and new standards that directly contradicted standards that they had established in a prior rule without a ruling.
We're still on the finality, where Judge Kavanaugh started us. We're still on the question of finality. You're arguing the merits. I understand your arguments on the merits. Our concern, I think all three of us, our concern is you're here too early.
I understand that argument. We are not arguing here with respect to this first argument, with respect to the APA lack of notice and comment rulemaking. We are not arguing that it is substantively erroneous. We are arguing that with respect to the finality challenge. But what we're arguing here is a straight up and clean argument that the agency, in order to amend its rules, and there are legions of cases that say this, in order to amend its rules, the agency must engage in notice and comment rulemaking. And this court in the national...
But you can raise that after the final determination in this case.
Which, of course, you knew.
Surely, but we can also raise it now, is our
point. Well, no, I know. I'm just saying, it's not like this argument's going to go away. The one you just said. You'll still be able to argue that in challenging the final determination. You'll have a plethora of arguments, no doubt, and one of them could be this.
Right. And this court said in National Association of Home Builders versus the Army Corps of Engineers, I quote, "A purely legal claim in the context of a facial challenge is presumptively reviewable." And what happened in that case, end quote, what happened in that case is that the Army Corps of Engineers was in the middle of an adjudication issuing what they called nationwide permits under, I think, Section 404. And what happened was they said, we are going to apply these permits in a different way. And the National Association of Home Builders took an appeal directly. And the court said, we have jurisdiction to hear that because the agency amended a rule without engaging in notice and comment rulemaking. And that's why I want to distinguish from the outset that we are making two different arguments here.
You had a final determination there. You had a final appealable order. Of course you can make that claim I can think of one that Judge Ginsburg has written, the same thing, where you looked at the final determination made by the agency, and in his case, I can't remember the name of it, he said, you've effectively amended the preceding rule with the issuance of your final order. Go back and do it through notice and comment rulemaking. Yes, you're absolutely right. We do that all the time.
And that is what the agency has done here. The agency has adopted a rule of general applicability that it applied in this case, that it applied in the next case. It is a binding rule. It definitively determines the rights of the parties as to which of challenge rates are within their limited jurisdiction.
But there are no adverse consequences that have flowed to your client at this point.
Your Honor, our
position... None will flow until, except the inconvenience of having to litigate, and you know you get nowhere with that one. That's
our position, right, and
the second part of Bennett you can't meet. Assuming you're right on the first
and we this is a separate argument not under Bennett that I'm trying to,
I know.
To discuss here. We do have an injury. It is a procedural injury. It is a completed injury, which this court has said on numerous occasions is immediately appealable because it will never be more final than it is now. They have deprived.
I think we may be. I know the cases you're talking about, and I think those cases say and I realize there are some of them that kind of all over the place, but I think the theme is when there is a final order issued determining the substantive rights of the parties or taking away substantive rights, you then can come in and challenge that final order, and among the things you can say is what they did was to establish a rule without following notice and comment rulemaking. Your problem here is you don't have the final order.
I understand that argument, and the government makes that argument. The Hobbs Act divides into rules, regulations, and final orders. It doesn't say final orders that establish rules. It says rules, regulations, and final orders.
Right.
And the court, this court has considered rules that were issued in the middle of an adjudication, has considered those before the adjudication is completed. I admit it doesn't happen very often because most agencies are aware that they may not adopt a rule in the context of an adjudication.
Well, but agencies, the government says here, agencies adopt interim legal conclusions in the context of an adjudication all the time. And the government says, and I just want to get your response, if an interim agency determination were considered a final order simply because the underlying issues were legal in nature, any litigant that loses a preliminary dispositive motion on purely legal grounds could then bring an immediate appeal in order to avoid further litigation costs, and this court would be inundated with interlocutory appeals. So can you respond to that?
Well, two things. First of all, this is the first time there has ever been an appeal from this agency on this, and I don't anticipate that
won't
after
be the
agency's experience,
win,
it will be any different.
If you win, I think that makes their point, which is this is unusual argument by you, and if you were to win, that would open the floodgates to further litigation, interlocutory, anytime someone loses something that they might call purely legal issue.
I think not, Your Honor. What the agency has done here is establish radically different standards and rules from those it has heretofore applied. And that is our challenge. It's a facial challenge to the new standards. We are not challenging the application to the facts here. We are challenging the new standard.
Yeah, the thing that bothered me when I first started reading this is you're assuming there's a statutory requirement, at least implicit in your argument, that there's a statutory requirement that they bifurcate. But you honestly said to me, no, if they had denied your motion to bifurcate, you couldn't appeal it. The only way you can get at this question now is because they bifurcated. They didn't have to bifurcate. They could have done what they've done in every case up to now. Not bifurcate, just take the whole thing, and you wait for the final decision, and then you throw everything at them. Your starting premise is wrong. You have no right to bifurcation under the statute.
I didn't mean to say we had any right to bifurcate.
No, I know, but it's implicit in your argument, because otherwise you're not here but for the fact that they bifurcated.
My argument, Your Honor, is that once the agency makes a jurisdictional determination, that is appealable. That goes to the finality world, and our argument is, with respect to the notice and comment, is that the agency has adopted a new rule that is substantively, radically different from the rule and standards it applied before. And this court has held, rarely in adjudications, I acknowledge, but has held with respect to agency guidance and similar documents, that an agency pronouncement.
Right. Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
An agency pronouncement that changes the legal regime,
right,
enacted without notice and comment rulemaking, that effectively amends an existing rule, and the agency doesn't deny that it adopted these rules, and every time it amended these rules in the prior 30 years, it did so through notice and comment rulemaking. The court has held that sort of modification is immediately revealable.
Right, in a guidance document, for example, where those are final in the sense of nothing's going to come after, but in the context of an adjudication, your argument's clever, I think.
And that's a good smile. It is,
yeah,
clever.
It is clever, but I just think this would open a real
bad thing for counsel to hear.
Yes, it? No, I know, but it would open a new avenue for interlocutory appeals, I think. But anyway, we've heard your argument. We'll give you time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Ted Hunt, good morning. Ted Hunt on behalf of the Surface Transportation Board and the United States. We should not be before the court today. CSX has prematurely appealed two interlocutory non-final board orders. Because the board's ongoing proceedings on the merits may moot all of CSX's challenges to the board's orders, board's market dominance orders, and because there are no impacts to CSX other than to require them to continue to participate in the agency proceedings, the board's orders are not final, and CSX's piecemeal appeal should be dismissed.
That's your second prong of Bennett, your argument.
That's second. The first prong, if I can go right to it, this court has said recently in the context of an agency adjudication in the Blue Ridge case that consummation of agency proceedings means that the agency has disposed of all issues as to all parties. And that's because later proceedings, as in this case, the rate reasonableness proceedings need to be decided. And those proceedings can moot any of the concerns that CSX has in this case. Because actually, if the board finds that CSX's rates are reasonable in the ongoing proceedings that are taking place right now, then CSX is not aggrieved. It cannot appeal under the Hobbs Act. So under both prong one and prong two of the two-part test for finality, CSX cannot meet it. What counsel has attempted to argue here is that there is some sort of new novel theory that if a party claims that the agency should have been doing notice and comment rulemaking instead of conducting an adjudication, they have an automatic right to review. That doesn't exist in any case law before that this court has decided anywhere.
Your mistake, at least on their theory, was in bifurcating. You'll know in the future never to bifurcate.
I think that's probably fair to say.
It occurred to me this has never happened before, at least that I could find.
But it is efficient.
Yeah, right. It's efficient.
I think the
so they're using an efficient. They requested something that was efficient, and now they want to use it to get at the case piecemeal.
Exactly. I think that they made a motion to bifurcate, saying we have some preliminary evidence we'd like to show you that shows that there is really no market dominance here. And the board took a look at it and said, you know, there may be a question here, so let's go ahead and take a look at this. We're not going to make you file all your initial evidence on rate reasonableness right away, and now we're here.
As a matter of curiosity, I just couldn't answer this question for myself. Is it possible that when you get to the second stage of the proceeding, having found the market dominance preliminarily, that you could change your mind on the market dominance?
The board has the authority to do that, but
I've never done it that not, you're aware of.
Not that I'm aware of.
72 markets in play here, right?
Two markets. I'm sorry.
How many markets?
72. Sure. Yeah. There's 72.
It would have to
happen
on all 72.
But what CSX tries to do here is they essentially say, well, we have an automatic right because we're claiming you should have done notice and comment rulemaking. When you look at the cases they cite to, that's not supported. The National Association of Home Builders case, the court actually walks through the two-part Bennett test and decides there that yes, finality exists because the Corps of Engineers had issued a nationwide permit and that affected parties outside the proceeding. Who had to go get a permit before the Corps to discharge in wetlands and who didn't. The other cases they cite, the GE case, another guidance document case, a non-adjudication where the court said, look, the agency has changed how it is allowing parties to show due risk assessments for PCBs. The NRDC case, as well as the Appalachian Power, involved the Clean Air Act, and these were guidance documents that had implications outside out in the day-to-day operations and how the agency was interpreting those statutes. In fact, in the Appalachian Power case on page 1022, I believe, the court says that just because the issue may be binding, it may be a legislative rule that's binding on all parties, doesn't satisfy the finality test. You still have to walk through that two-part analysis to see if there's...
Suppose they win on rate reasonableness. How do they ever get to challenge the underlying legal question?
It becomes moot, so they wouldn't be able to challenge it at that point, but if the board were to use that approach again in another case, then a party could challenge that if, again, they lose on the rate reasonableness side. The board has used the three-step approach that is decided, or that it used in this case, in one other rate case that decided in March, I believe, called the DuPont case. And because it was a similar fact pattern, involved many, many chemical shipments over many, many routes, it used the same three-step approach, but after it considered what the parties were suggesting, the other approaches that the parties were suggesting. So the board hasn't adopted this as a binding legal rule that is going to apply to all cases. In fact, the flexible guidelines that go back to 1981 specifically say that they are non-binding and they're not mandatory, they're non-exhaustive.
I mean, I understand that argument. I'm just giving them the benefit of the doubt, assuming the opposite of your position, that is, that it is not so flexible as you claim. How do they get at it? Can they petition for can a regulated party petition for rulemaking?
It could, certainly could do that, and we have not received, I don't believe, any petition like that on to change the market dominance rules, excuse me. But it really comes down to an adjudication, whether they are ultimately an aggrieved party. If a rail carrier loses, it can then appeal these market dominant issues if they disagree with them. One other case I'd like to mention is that Councilor Cusack mentioned was the Athlone case. That case is sort of an outlier, I guess, it's not decided under the finality, two-part finality prong. It's an exhaustion case. And what if you read the fact pattern in there and get deep into it, it basically says, look, the agency has found liability here. Because they found that they had not reported certain instances of harm to parties, and the CPSC came down on them and said, look, okay, so we're finding you liable, but in reality, we're going to fine you, and that's the issue that came before the court. And there was a strange fact pattern there in that there was a co-defendant that the Eighth Circuit had decided that they were going to stay the action as well against that co-defendant already. So I think the D.C. Circuit took that into account as well. But it's clear that CSX cannot satisfy the two-part finality test. Their novel theory over that they've suggested today that they have automatic review without satisfying is not supported by the case law. But if the court does reach the merits, the respondents believe that the board's decisions were entirely reasonable, not arbitrary and capricious, and they did not violate the APA or the Interstate Commerce Act. To the extent the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Your Honors, a few points in response to the government's argument. First of all, he describes Athlone as an outlier. You may or may not be familiar with the subsequent history of that case. A subsequent case, ARCO, affirmed the rule in Athlone. And then, in a split decision, the lead opinion in a case called Tyco Title Insurance expressly said that Athlone was the law of this circuit unless and until changed. So there may not be a lot of cases, but Athlone does represent the law of this circuit. Second of all, Judge Edwards, you asked about whether the statute was jurisdictional. And I agree that it does not say in the statute that it's jurisdictional. However, I'd like to make two points that suggest that it is jurisdictional.
Not the statute as a whole. The way you're parsing it, it's a curious notion. That is, I think you're trying to say that there's a jurisdictional component which requires the board to decide the market dominance question first, resolve it, you get an answer on it, and that's a jurisdictional matter, and if they come up with the wrong answer, they can't go any further.
I think that is our position. And the
one problem you have, I don't mean to interrupt you so you know what I'm saying, the problem you have is the bifurcation problem. They don't have to do it in a separate proceeding, and they never have before. And that's where your argument falls apart. It's all part of one proceeding, and then at the end of it, you have the right to go after the market monitor, go after the reasonable rate finding, and anything else you think they did wrong.
True. Those are two separate decisions, though. The agency would not deny, I'm sure, that the jurisdictional determination has no substantive bearing on the rate reasonableness. But what I'd like to get to as to the jurisdictional question is,
that's
first
the
of all,
authority question. I mean, the Supreme Court says not.
The agency and all the parties before the agency have consistently referred to it as jurisdictional requirement. Second of all, this court in a case called Coal Trading Association in roughly 1985, that this court held that the market dominance requirement was jurisdictional because Congress intended to limit the jurisdiction of the agency to only those rates
dominance. I found several cases where that word jurisdiction is used. It just doesn't get you where you want to go because you still want what you're trying to make is this argument that I'm entitled to get that answer first and then challenge it if it's not favorable. And that that's never been the practice. And it's totally inconsistent with what we normally do, which is require parties to finish an adjudication before we we rule on it.
Okay, our position was we did get that determination. Not that we are entitled to it, but we did get that determination. One final point that I'd like, because I think the court and the government have suggested that there is an absolute requirement that you meet the Bennett or the, you know, and its progeny require finality test before you can even show that a APA violation is sufficient to get immediate review. And I'd like to cite you to one case. This case is called Center for Auto Safety versus NHTSA. And that case says, adoption, and this is a quote, adoption of a de facto legislative rule without a rulemaking clearly satisfies Bennett's test for final agency action, end of quote, and is reviewable final agency action.
That was a guidance, yeah. That was a guidance case.
Yeah.
But it's a de facto legislative rule, which is precisely that we have here. I don't think it turned on the fact that it was guidance.
Oh, they, when they issued the guidance, they had done everything they were going to do.
Right, that
was the consummation.
There wasn't anything more to go on.
That was the consummation. That was over.
And the agency has done everything it's going to do on this market dominance test now. And, in fact, it applied the exact same test in the next case.
You can say that about every issue where several are required in order to reach to the end of the case. They've done everything they're going to do on whatever timing or
right.
or number of who are parties and who are not.
Okay, the agency clearly intends to apply this to future cases, so this affects all the regulated parties that are before.
That's true generally, or often in adjudications, right? Setting a precedent, whether it's framed as a rule or simply a set of facts.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court has said, another one is Marseille Water versus FERC, that an agency may not adopt a rule in the course of an adjudication. And that is our position. That is what the agency has done. That is a completed procedural injury.
Well,
Nothing further needs to be done, and it's immediately reviewable.
You have an argument under, I guess, Bell Aerospace at the end of the day.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is submitted, and we will take a brief break.